Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. You may recall that not too long ago, there was a little bit of a brouhaha in the House of Representatives when Father Patrick Conroy, who is the chaplain of the House of Representatives, was asked to resign by Speaker Paul Ryan. And it had to do with an invocation that he had made not too far in advance of this. The Senate was in the process of constructing a spending bill and tax legislation, and he asked for, if I may paraphrase, some compassion to make sure that in this final bill that would become law, there would not be winners and losers. So he was... He was essentially talking truth to power at that moment, encouraging the people who would vote on this legislation to look into their souls and view it with the understanding that they are impacting people's lives. And so, as I say, there was some controversy. He has since rescinded his resignation. He is now back in the saddle again. And when I read this story, I thought, you know, we, in all of these years of Common Threads, have never done a story on chaplains. And so I was able to find the source of one particular article that was of interest to me. It was written in part by Wendy Kadge. She is a professor in the Department of Sociology at Brandeis University. And she's with us here today. A little bit about Wendy. She is an expert in contemporary American religion, especially related to religion in public institutions, diversity, immigration, and healthcare. She is the author of two books, Paging God, Religion in the Halls of Medicine, and Heartwood, the First Generation of Theravada Buddhism in America. And she's the co-editor of Religion on the Edge, Decentering and Recentering the Sociology of Religion. On the campus of Brandeis, she is the chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program and a faculty representative to the Board of Trustees. So we welcome to Common Threads Professor Wendy Kadge. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. My first question is, as I look at the body of your work, you yourself are quite diverse in the areas of religion that you study and that you teach about. One of the areas is, of course, chaplaincy, and you don't limit yourself to chaplaincy in government, but also in the armed forces, in medicine. I'm just curious how you happen to find this particular niche to work in.
That's a great question, Fred. Thanks for it. My first book was a study of how Theravada Buddhism that historically came from Southeast Asia, moved and changed in the United States. And as part of that research, I spent more than a year at a Thai temple outside of Philadelphia. And the head monk there, who had been born and raised in Thailand and come to Philadelphia to lead this temple called Wat Mongkul Tempo Ni, or Wat Phila, short for Philadelphia, he was ill in the course of my research. And near the end of my research, I visited him at a local hospital and spent time with him, still a monk in the bright orange robes of a monk from Southeast Asia in the Theravada Buddhist tradition. And I wondered how the physicians and nurses in this hospital would care for him, and if they might care for him in ways that were any different from how they would care for anyone else. And it was by sitting literally at the end of his hospital bed that I started to wonder how hospitals and healthcare organizations respond to spirituality and religion, and particularly what role, if any, chaplains play in that. So it was that experience and then some subsequent funding I was able to get that led me to spend a good number of years learning about healthcare chaplains. And then once you start learning about some chaplains, it's hard not to learn about others. So from there, I came to learn about chaplains in ports and airports and the military and many other places.
So if you would, could you finish that story? How was his care in the hospital?
So he had been traveling from Philadelphia, I suspect, to MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas, though I don't know that for sure, because it was really important to him that he be treated by Thai-born physicians and Thai-speaking physicians. So at the time he was actually admitted to this hospital, he had become too ill to travel. And he was admitted first, I believe, to their general care unit, and then to the hospice or palliative care wing of the hospital, where he died just a few days after I saw him. So when I spent time with him there, Thai etiquette is that when a lay person is in the presence of a monk, the top of their head has to be below the head of the monk. So he was laying on the bed, which is why I was sitting almost on the floor at the end of his bed. And there were other monks and many lay people from the temple there making sure that he was cared for alongside the doctors and the nurses. Thai monks also have particular rules about gender interactions. They don't physically touch women, and so that was another thing to be negotiated. So my impression is that the staff there were quite compassionate, that there were many other monks and lay people there to assist, and that they made him as comfortable as they could as his life ended.
That's nice to hear. I can tell you that here in Grand Rapids, we at the Interfaith Dialogue Association have been contacted many times by hospice organizations and by hospitals and other medical personnel to advise them on the care of the patients who practice any one of the many religions that have representation here in West Michigan. Which is quite different, I think, around 15 years ago. A good friend of mine had to enter the hospital. She went to emergency because she was suffering some pain. And she says that she goes up to the in registration, and they ask her, "What religion are you?" And she says, "Hindu." And they says, "We don't have that here." You can't be Hindu in this hospital. So she became a Lutheran just to make it easy on everyone. No, she didn't. But anyway, that is just the revolution of healthcare as in regards to people's religions here in West Michigan has changed. And I suspect that is true for quite a bit of the United States. Am I correct?
One of the things that's interesting is that the ways that hospitals respond to spirituality and religion are extremely idiosyncratic. I have been in the same city at two large academic medical centers literally across the street from one another, where one would have embraced your friend as a Hindu and been quite familiar with that, and the other one probably would have been much more akin to how your friend was actually treated. So one of the challenges in healthcare chaplaincy, and honestly in chaplaincy across all sectors today, are thinking about big questions about how chaplains are trained, how they're integrated in institutions, and when that's done in similar ways, and when that's really idiosyncratic and very largely dependent on the specific organization and the people who are there.
And I'm assuming that a lot of hospitals might work with the model that we have here. So for instance, a local hospital, if they were to get a Hindu or a Buddhist or someone, a Sikh, in as a patient, the chaplain may not feel capable of providing that care, but will then call someone from an institution that they have an arrangement with to come and fulfill that role of spiritual advisor at that point. Is that correct?
I think that is pretty common. Certainly they would get the patient's permission before they made that phone call, given HIPAA and other rules about patient privacy.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that's a given. Sure.
It is important to point out, though, that historically in hospitals, chaplains were staffed by tradition. So if someone came in and they were Catholic, they'd be seen by the Catholic chaplain. Increasingly, chaplains are being staffed by unit, which means that there's a chaplain who is a multi-faith chaplain assigned to, say, the medical intensive care unit. And their job is to see everyone on that unit. Now, if they need someone who is Catholic or Hindu, certainly they can make that call inside or outside of the hospital if needed. But it's interesting to see the staffing model actually transition from a tradition-specific model to one that is more multi or interfaith.
And how is that working out? Did you keep apprised of that? In terms of the reaction of the patients. So I'm thinking that maybe 40, 50 years ago, a Baptist in a hospital room sees a chaplain who's Catholic, there may not be nothing to talk about. Is there more acceptance by the patient of people who don't fit exactly into their worldview, their religion?
It's a good question. There aren't as many outcome-based studies of chaplaincy as we would like, but there is some good evidence that patients who see a chaplain in a healthcare organization are more satisfied with their stay in that organization than those who do not see a chaplain. But we actually don't have data about the match between their religion and the religious tradition of the chaplain, so I'm not sure we can really answer your question empirically. My impression from talking with hundreds of healthcare chaplains is that in general this works pretty well, in particular because chaplains are clear that they are one of the few people who, when they come to the door of a hospital room, can always be sent away, so that no patient or family member is ever obliged to talk with them. And often those who do are welcoming to them and to the kind of space and care that they bring.
Certainly. This is my impression, as I say, working with Interfaith Dialogue Association and the hospitals, but I had no empirical evidence on it. And from what you say, there really isn't, but there is anecdotal evidence that it is working well from the point of view of the chaplains. That's nice to hear. Did hospital chaplaincy, from what I understand you saying, that came before your interest in government chaplaincy, is that correct?
It did. So I spent 6 or 8 years working on the book that became Paging God, which is the book that looks at how religion and spirituality are present in big academic hospitals. And I look at chaplains, but I also look at chapels, meditation, and prayer rooms. I interviewed many physicians and nurses in intensive care units, realizing that many of the times spiritual or religious issues come up in hospitals, chaplains are nowhere to be found. So after I completed that work, I was aware, and I had wondered quite a bit before, about how hospitals respond to spirituality and religion differently or similarly from other organizations. You know, how is religion addressed in a hospital different from in the military or in a port or in an airport? And so I spent a summer after completing that book in Boston, where I live, making a list of every institution I could find that had a chaplain, and just doing some very casual, informal conversation with those chaplains about their work. And interestingly, the group that I found that was most intriguing to me were chaplains who work in ports. So these are individuals that go on board container ships and provide care for the staff of cruise ships. So I then spent some time, and I'm still engaged in a series of projects looking at port chaplains. And then airport chaplains, and it was only that I came to government chaplains after those.
So let's talk about the government, because obviously I began this conversation talking about the controversy that is recently brewed. So let's go back to the beginning, because you certainly do in this one particular article that you wrote for The Conversation. You indicate that you have quite a bit of knowledge of the history. Now, first question is this. I think that a lot of Americans think that this whole controversy, this debate about the separation of church and state, it only goes back to the 1980s with the rise of the moral majority and Ronald Reagan's ascendancy to the presidency. I think that's probably the very first time I heard of it, but it really goes back to the genesis of the nation. And I'm just curious, what controversy, if ever, what controversies were there when it came to things like invocations at the openings of congressional sessions and the establishment of chaplaincy?
Great questions. So as far as we can gather, and this work I have done in collaboration with Laura Olson, who is a professor of political science at Clemson University, and with Margaret Milken, who is a PhD student in sociology here at Brandeis. So as far as we can tell, the American tradition of legislative prayer dates to 1774, when Jacob Duché, who was the rector of Christ Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, was recruited to offer prayers before the First Continental Congress. Chaplaincy or chaplain positions came a little bit after that time. The House of Representatives chose William Lynn, who was a Philadelphia Presbyterian minister, to be its first chaplain in May of 1789. And the U.S. Senate selected an Episcopal bishop from New York, Samuel Provost, as its chaplain in April of 1789. Now, I have not myself looked at the primary documents, so I don't know if there was controversy at that time, but I can tell you that there has been controversy since, and not only in the past few months. So in the 1850s, Congress received a number of positions calling for the elimination of the position of chaplain in the House and in the Senate. In the 1980s, in 1983 in particular, a lawsuit led by Ernest Chambers, who is a member of the Nebraska State Legislature, made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and this is the Marsh v. Chambers case, in which the question was, should there continue to be prayers offered before the opening of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives by congressional chaplains? The fact that we still have these positions lets you know that the court decided in Marsh v. Chambers to defer to historical custom rather than asserting a firm boundary of church and state, or between church and state, and so the positions have remained to the present.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Wendy Kaj. She is a professor in the Department of Sociology at Brandeis University, and today we're talking about chaplaincy. So in the 19th century, who were the people who were in opposition to the chaplaincy? One gets the impression, and it may be false, that the nation was fairly united in its understanding that this was a Christian nation, even though, of course, we had the First Amendment, freedom of religion, and no official state religion. But still, nonetheless, public religion was virtually everywhere. So can you tell us who led this?
That's a good question. My understanding is that the people who were writing the letters in the 1850s were concerned about church-state separation, and they were also concerned about the ways in which chaplains were appointed, which was a bit more informal than the process is today. So part of resolving that conflict was actually to develop a formal selection process through which chaplains would be brought into the House and the Senate.
And when somebody becomes a chaplain, there are a few different responsibilities that they have. One is delivering invocations, and these invocations happen every day that the body is meeting. Is that correct?
Before 1939, chaplains delivered prayers at the start of each legislative day, which sometimes ran across several calendar days. Today, that is not the case. So today, they do deliver the prayers at the start of each session in the morning. And in addition to delivering the prayers, they do have other responsibilities pertaining to providing pastoral care to the staff. And actually, they serve officially as formal officers of the chambers in which they serve.
And what does that mean, being an official officer?
My understanding is that it sort of just specifies what they do and how they come to that. So they are actually nominated by bipartisan committees. Historically, these positions have been seen both as strictly nonpartisan and as nonsectarian. But then each body, the Senate and the House, vote on separate resolutions. So each body in the end does select its own chaplain. House chaplains are elected to 2-year terms at the beginning of each Congress. And Senate chaplains actually do not have to be reelected. Once they have been appointed, they remain until they step down.
And is this a position that people specifically seek out, or oftentimes would the government make the first move? That is to say, just contact a clergy member and say, we think you would be a good candidate for chaplain.
My sense is that it's more the latter. Barry Black, the current chaplain to the U.S. Senate, is a former naval chaplain. So I think sometimes they reach out through those sorts of networks. But part of what Professor Olson and Margaret Milken and I realized in our research is that each chaplain has been pretty idiosyncratic. They have each crafted the role in their own way. And we actually analyzed their prayers, which enabled us to get a sense of how they perceived both their job and their responsibility to the body that they were serving.
Oh, to tell us what you came up with in a few instances.
Well, so we looked at chaplains between 1990 and 2010. So there were six people, all men. And in fact, as a note, I should say that all of the congressional chaplains have been men. They, with the exception of one, have been white men, and they have all been Christians. So they are far from representing the diversity either of Congress or of the U.S. public. The U.S. public is certainly more religiously diverse than chaplains. But when we looked at these five individuals, these five men who held this office, we saw a couple of things that were interesting over time. The first is when we looked at the Senate chaplains, we saw them moving from using a lot of Christian-centric language in the early 1990s, a lot of biblical references, to today having much more religiously neutral prayer. So almost no mention of Jesus, of particular biblical stories or biblical verses. In the House, interestingly, we didn't see that at all. The House chaplains continued to have, you know, a range of frameworks in the way that they prayed. That was one of the main findings. The other thing that's particularly relevant to the conflict about Father Patrick Conroy is we looked at the extent to which chaplains mentioned current events, current policy issues, these sorts of things in their prayers. And while we did not analyze Father Patrick Conroy's prayers, our data show clearly that his prayer was no more political, no more, you know, centered on a policy issue than that of many of his predecessors. And that's an important point that I think hasn't been brought fully into the conversation about his position.
That is quite fascinating. Why do you suppose that that particular prayer bothered the Speaker of the House?
That's a great question, and one I'm not sure I can comment on. It just strikes me that if this particular prayer bothered him, many, many prayers, both of Conroy and of other House and Senate chaplains, historically would have bothered him even more.
It's interesting that you say that you see in the Senate this move away from a heavy Christological foundation, and yet you see no change in the House. It kind of doesn't surprise me, because I do know that you have this like the Freedom Caucus and the Liberty Caucus. You have a lot of very conservative Christians in the House, but I really thought that they had their counterparts in the Senate. Is that not quite as true?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question, and this remains really a puzzle to us, because when we look, there are two kinds of people who pray before the Senate and the House. One are the chaplains who are the formal chaplains to the bodies. Those are the ones that we've been discussing, and those are the five that we analyze in our paper. But both the Senate and the House also occasionally invite visitors to come and offer a prayer just one time, as a you know, way of honoring someone or bringing someone from a particular congressional district or what have you. And the House tends to have many more visitors than does the Senate. And it's actually many of these visitors that have tended to sort of religiously diversify those who are offering the prayers. So it wasn't until 1965 that the first woman prayed before the Senate. The first Muslim prayed before the Senate in 1992. And despite a small protest, the first Hindu prayed before the Senate in 2000. But the House's guest chaplains have actually been much more widely diverse in terms of their religious traditions and or backgrounds. So that's actually the opposite, right? If we're finding that the Senate chaplain, their prayers move towards being more religiously neutral, but the House's did not, yet at the same time, we find that the visitors to the House are more religiously diverse than those to the Senate. So this is really a puzzle that we're not completely sure how to understand at this point.
In your article, you mentioned the guests, and you mentioned Hindu and Muslim. You didn't mention Jewish. Have there been Jewish guest chaplains or guest ministers, rabbis rather?
There have been.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That is. Are you going to continue your work on this to find some of the answers that you're bringing up today, the answers to questions you're bringing up today?
I hope so, because at the end of our article that we published on this work, we said very clearly, we think we've raised more questions than answers in this work to date. One of the interesting questions we haven't talked about yet is that it's not just at the national or at the federal level that there are chaplains, but many state house and senate, as well as in some cities and other areas, have chaplains as well. And so we've wondered about starting to look at which state bodies have chaplains, who they are, and sort of how this happens at a more local level. We haven't started that work yet, but there's actually quite a bit that happens here around legislative chaplains that no one sort of has thought through and understood to date.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying that there are states whose legislative bodies don't have chaplains. I always assumed that, you know, all 50 legislative bodies would have had chaplains, but that is not necessarily the case?
We believe that that is not necessarily the case, and we are looking for the data to back up our assertion.
I see. Okay. Well, Wendy, we are down to the wire for this particular episode of Common Threads, but much more to talk about here, so I'm hoping that you can have time for us next week.
Terrific. Thank you.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Professor Wendy Kaj. She is a professor in the Department of Sociology at Brandeis University. The subject of the day is chaplaincy, and we will continue this conversation same time, same station here on WGVU.